Welcome to Meat Lake Production Interviews. This podcast is the audio version of video interviews that can be found in our YouTube channel or at meatlake.com. The video version will include many visual references that cannot be addressed in audio format. The podcast will now commence. Well, welcome to another Meat Lake Productions interview. I am Eric Meat Lake, and I have with me today Neil Wade. Neil currently holds the title of current series manager with Nickelodeon, and that produces a lot of content, including Star Trek Prodigy, which we will ask about later on in the interview today. Let's see, Neil, you've got quite a long resume, and you've worked on a variety of projects that people may be familiar with. Let me just read off a little bit of your resume here. First, how are you today? Hello, nice to meet you.
I'm great, man. It's, I know we're just chatting, but yeah, I'm here in San Diego. Comic-Con's about to kick off, and that's always an exciting time for me. So just in good spirits, feeling great.
Yeah, that's great. Sounds like a lot of fun. So let's see. I just want to read off a bit of your resume. Like you worked, starting like 2009, you were a production intern for Dora the Explorer. That was with Nickelodeon, is that correct?
Yes, on Dora and Diego, no less. So.
And then also, let's see, from 2019 to 2012, you were design persistent for Family Guy with Fox TV Animation.
Yes, I was design PA. Some great people there for sure.
And then let's see, 2014 to 2015, production coordinator for Pig Goat Banana Cricket, which I looked up. Little screenshot here. I'll throw it behind me. This is it's a very nice, very Ren and Stimpy like animation style. And it's a lot of fun. I watched some of the clips on YouTube there.
Yeah. Had a really great, really unique look and really strong, like, creative team. And just one of my first experiences with like a first season brand new show. But the team that we brought together just really pulled off a really gorgeous show.
Yeah, it's really worth looking up and checking out online. Then let's see, from like 2015, 2017, social media coordinator for Nickelodeon. And then 2017, 2019, you worked on Cleopatra in Space with DreamWorks. Yes. I've got a little screenshot of that here for people that are not familiar with it. Can you tell us a little bit about that production as well? That had three seasons, Cleopatra. Correct?
Yeah, it had two seasons. It's streaming on Peacock now. It's based on a graphic novel series, and just really, you know, another case of just a really like perfect storm of wonderful people coming together. And, I really love the fact that, you know, had a POC female color of lead who is really unique. You know, this version of Cleopatra, you know, is cast 30,000 years into the future into a very Egyptian inspired kind of intergalactic empire, and just, you know, it was a really fun character, really unique, another one that had a really great look, and behind the scenes, just like a powerhouse team of creators.
Yeah, it looks really interesting too. I'm definitely gonna, I've got that on my watch list now as well. So.
Oh yeah. I mean, I personally am going to lobby for a season 3, 4, and 5 for the rest of my life, but you know, we'll see. We'll see if DreamWorks is listening.
Yeah. Let's see. And then, since 2020, it looks like your title has been manager of animated current series, which is one of the things that you're doing right now. So one of the things that I like to ask is I like to ask questions that maybe, you know, like a younger version of myself would want to know. So like, what was it that made you want to get involved in the animation industry overall?
I tell people, a million different things. But, you know, I grew up and I was... I love cartoons. My family, my parents didn't have us watching a lot of TV during the week in particular. So, and when we did watch TV, we had to kind of have a certain amount of reading done or studying done to earn those hours. So early, you know, Saturdays were really when I got to watch TV. And of course, that was Saturday morning cartoons. It's the only time you get me up before 12 when I was a kid even. So, but there were always just that the imagination that I saw and kind of the storytelling that the craft itself inspired always kind of stuck with me. And there's something really beautiful about seeing drawings come to life. Right. And, you know, I've always been the kid who loved to draw, always been into comic books. So the visual storytelling was there growing up with me. I will say the first time I ever was like, I want to make cartoons. Well, I was probably in college, my freshman year. Mm-hmm. So if everyone wants to know how old I am, my freshman year, The Prince of Egypt came out. And it was such a mature form of storytelling. And like, I'd already been a fan of anime, but I had never considered a career in making it. But anime was just, it was this very unique form of animation that at the time, you know, was not very popular. I keep telling people I was into anime before anime was cool. and so, it was The Prince of Egypt that I saw, and just seeing this, you know, mature feature film, beautiful animation, that I was like, wow, like it would be really cool to do that. And I made a very weak attempt at my school to find an animation program. And I remember I went to the art school and I was like, hey, I want to do animation. And they're like, hey, yeah, there's a girl here who does animation. And they introduced me to her. But at the time she didn't speak English. And they kind of were like, hey, yeah, why don't you sit with her and hang out? And I wasn't, you know, as ambitious as I am now. So I kind of was like, nice to meet you. See you later. And so that was the end of my college experience with animation. The big turning point that actually led me on this path was when at my senior year in college, I was studying architecture because in my head that had been, you know, drawing and a profession and my parents will, you know, be satisfied and I'll still be able to draw. It hit me during my senior year. I was like, oh my God, I don't want to be an architect. And, you know, I had that 20-year-old crisis that everyone has. And one of my friends who was actually from Japan, he came to me and he said, hey man, like, why don't you just go teach English in Japan? You're such a manga anime weirdo, like just go do that. And I was like, what are you talking about? And he's like, yeah, you know, when I was in high school, I had a bunch of, you know, a couple of different American teachers who would come and teach my class. So I looked into it and I discovered the JET program. Right. And I applied thinking I would never ever get in. And luckily I did. And I tell people it was the best decision of my life, completely put me on the correct trajectory. It was built my understanding of the world, built my understanding of people and just understanding a global community and how much we really are just alike. And yet so different in beautiful ways. But while I was there, I went and saw Mind Game, which is a film by Masaaki Uwasa. And I remember walking out of that film and I turned to my friend. I was like, I don't know how, but I want to go do that. And so, you know, I finished out my time teaching there, came back to the U.S. And I had a really good friend in California. And she's like, hey, like, you know, if you want to do animation, this is where you need to be. You need to go to CalArts. And I was like, I don't know about California. But as I was spinning my wheels more and more in my hometown and not going anywhere, I was like, I've got to do something. I've got to get out of here. I've got to do something different. And just one day about a year into it, I got up in the morning and talked to my mom. And I was like, hey, mama, can I borrow your car? I'm moving to California. And I think she was just happy that I decided to do anything. I was not going to be in her house anymore. So she's like, you get a week. She's like, give it a week. And then if a week you still want to go, you can take my car and go. So week went by, got my things together. And I remember I had my laptop and its Rubbermaid tub and a blanket. And I drove out to California to become an animator. And I applied to a few animation programs. So, you know, some of the bigger schools. Got a place, got a little job. I thought I was really doing it. And about 6 months in, I got rejection letters from every single place I applied to. I also got fired from a job that's not on the resume. And my roommate at the time left. So I was like, okay, that's my, you know, at the time I had multiple jobs. So I was like, that was half my income. That was half my rent. And I now don't have a purpose here. And I was about to leave LA when a really great friend now, about time she was my neighbor, she's like, listen, if you leave this place, you are never ever, you're always going to sit and wonder, what if you become an animator? So you either go home and regret the rest of your life or you figure it out. And that was kind of like the fire I needed needed lit under my ass. So I figured it out. I went back to school. I went back to school and was kind of working towards a few different things. And this took a couple of years. And it was actually one of my instructors in school was like, hey, I can see that you really, really, really want to tell stories with your artwork. And what do you want to do? And I was like, well, animation was why I came out here. She's like, great. You're getting old. And so you either need to find a graduate program or you need an internship. And so in a panic, I just shot off letters to like every studio and like looked into their internship programs and just shot my resume out. And I heard back from Cartoon Network, Bang Zoom Entertainment, which is a small production house that does a lot of great work, and Nickelodeon. And from all three of them, rejections again. And so, but being my mother's son, I decided to be polite. I wrote handwritten, you know, thank you notes to all the people I corresponded with. And a manager of Nickelodeon internships called me back and she said, you know, that was a really sweet note you wrote to me. And I want to be honest, the only reason, accept your internship is because your materials came in a little too late. So here's the deal. We have another session coming up. Definitely reapply. And we'll see what happens. Right. And so I did that. And luckily that time around, I got in. And that was the beginning of my internship at Nickelodeon, the beginning of my career.
Nice. Wow. Yeah. So yeah, just extra little bit of kindness goes a long way sometimes.
You ask anyone I work with, I have like my rules of engagement and rules of operating in the, you know, in the industry. And that's number one. I'm like, be nice to everybody because you never know who that next opportunity will come from. You never know who will be your boss. You never know who will be your peer. And I say that knowing that, you know, there are interns of, you know, people who are interns of mine in the past who are, have now been positioned to help me get hired in other places. You know, DreamWorks, it was, you know, one of the people that really helped me get that position had been one of my former interns who is now a producer there. And so, you know, it's like I said, be nice to everybody. And a lot of people, it's networking. A lot of people talk about networking and it has a bad connotation and things like that. But I'm like, for me, networking is just making friends with people who do things you like to do.
Right.
And so, you know, being nice, it's not even about, well, I hope this person does give me that job, or I hope that person is going to do this for me. Mm-hmm. But it's just by nature, the network you have, the larger the network you have, the more opportunities will flow to you, the more people want to work with you, the more people know who you are and know what you're capable of and know what is a good fit for you. And so, so you end up having this like almost a social circle. And again, we're all animation nerds, so we're already kind of on a certain level, but you almost have this social circle that's built. That's only going to get better if you're nice to people. You know, there's no reason to be mean. And also in the animation, by and large, everyone is pretty nice. And so if you meet somebody who is not, the next guy is going to be really cool. Yeah.
Yeah, that's amazing. So don't give up. Keep being nice. Look for different pathways when you find a blockage in one area. It's a great way to look at how to get started.
Yes.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of that, like, for example, on Reddit and stuff, like in the animation section, you know, people asking how can I get started? So, I mean, I think this is a very inspirational story that I think, you know, we can share and give people, you know, some hope. So I think most people have kind of a general idea of what it means to be like, you know, showrunner, producer, director, kind of a hazy understanding. What is actually is the definition of current series manager? Like what kind of things does your particular job entail at the moment?
Yeah. So for a lot of people, you know, it's I describe it as I'm a creative executive. And so we're the guys you hear about who are like, yeah, the studio said we couldn't do this, or the executive said we couldn't do that. That's kind of the space that I'm in. Mm-hmm. But I'm the guy that says yes. So, but, you know, and also, you know, the role of the current series department is we manage our current series that are on air and in production at the moment. And I describe it as we're kind of cousins to development. And a lot more people seem to understand what development is. Development, of course, is where that's where they take the pitches, they work with a creator, and they develop the show into something that the network can use, the network can put on air. Right. So development all happens before the green light. We step in with the green light. When that show leaves development and they decide that this show is ready to go on air, it comes into our stable. And our job is to be like, okay, development created the show. the show is meant to be this, the character is meant to be this, the story is this. Our job is to make sure that the show stays on track that way. So we are kind of like the experts for whatever show we are assigned, you know? Mm. So if I was assigned a SpongeBob, or I mean, I am, you know, I work with Casa Grandes. And so it is my responsibility to know everything about this show, know everything about our character, you know, virtually, you know, most of the continuity, just I should know what's happening in every episode. So when things come to me, I can say, ooh, you know, maybe it's a freelance writer, for example, and I get a script and I'm like, ah, you know, that thing that, you know, Ronnie Anne just said, that's not something she would say. You know, what can we do to make this feel more like her character? Or if the story isn't working for one reason or another. So that's where the creative part of the creative executive kind of comes in. We have to kind of be really masters of storytelling and knowing what will and will not only work just as a story, but also what will resonate with our audience in the way that we want it to resonate. So, you know, there's sometimes something will come through and I'm like, you know what, that seems a little too mature for our 6 to 11 audience. Or something will be like, ah, you know what, that seems a little too young for our 6 to 11 audience. So it's really kind of understanding the show down to its bones and making sure that anything about that show, anything that goes out, whether it's the advertising, promotion, a partnership, all of it should stay in line with what we designed the show to be and say. So that's what our job is. It sounds, for a lot of people, that sounds a little tough. And it is. There. You know, at the end of the day, it's me having to justify my opinion on a show, but it's a very informed opinion, and I just love it. I love storytelling. I love dissecting stories. I love figuring out character. I love kind of, you know, interacting with the creators and people on the more creative side to work through and figure out how we make this, how we form this very creative project into something that hits all the marks we intended to hit.
When you are looking at editing story and dialogue and, you know, direction of character, are you looking at it at the, for example, like the storyboard point, or are you looking at it from like after they've already got, for example, some actual animation done, whether it's a 3D or whether 2D, or is it at all points? Are you looking at all points?
We are following it at every point. So that's from, you know, the very initial, you know, from often, you know, with a show like, a show like Star Trek Prodigy, you know, this is a first season, it's brand new. So like I was on it from the Bible, you know, the Bible being finalized to the first premise, through all the scripts, through all the boards, through all the animatics, up into the final animation. All that is something that kind of goes through us. What's great, and, you know, it's not just drinking the Kool-Aid. What's great is that we have such talented folks. It, you know, at a certain point, there's only so much that I need to watch for, you know, like, and also, you know, to that point, there are certain things and certain criteria that I like to follow at each stage. You know, there are things that I make sure I look for in the script so that I never see that in an animatic, right? You know, there's, you know, I shouldn't be making massive dialogue or story structural notes at the animatic stage. That should have all been worked out in the script. And if that hasn't happened, if I haven't caught all the things I need to catch, that's on me. And right. So at different stages, you know, there's a very different way to look at whatever materials are coming out. And, you know, to that point, I also say, each show is so different. You know, you hear this everywhere. Everything is so different. Every show and every production is so vastly different that, you know, I have to look at it with different eyes. The way I look at Star Trek Prodigy is very different from what I look at in the Casa Grandes, which is very different from what I look at in Big Nate. And in the past, you know, with other shows, it's just, you know, it's back to what did we design that show to be? And of course, each show is designed with a unique message. So how I make sure that message is coming out and being expressed is going to vary depending on what the nature of that show.
I see. Yeah. So it sounds like you're working on a lot of different shows at the same, like about how many shows are you working on right now? Are you managing?
I would say it's like 3 to 5 at a time. You know, some shows are a little more difficult. Again, a show that's starting up and brand new will demand a lot more time and energy than a show that's, you know, on its feet and running and has been on for a couple seasons. So at the moment, I'm on, you know, 3 shows. 2 of them are in their first seasons. That's Big Nate and Star Trek Prodigy. And, you know, it is a lot of work. You know, I tell people it takes a lot of time, and there's a lot of, you know, reading and then kind of, you know, dissecting what you're reading and then, you know, giving notes, and that sort of process that takes a minute. So it really does depend, versus like the Casa Grandes, which is in its third season. And, you know, I mean, at this point, you know, I'll get a first draft script. I can write off those notes like really quick, you know, within a few minutes after I'm done. And they usually aren't that many, versus, you know, Prodigy, which is just a heavier show. And so there's a lot more that you're looking at. You know, there's a lot more detail to watch out, and there's a lot more questions I'll have a lot of the time. So sometimes it won't be notes. I'll be like, hey, can we clarify this thing? And I'll get it clarified and like, oh, okay, that was something that was very much a visual story beat. And so, yeah, maybe didn't come across in script. So yeah, that's kind of that it really depends on the show and like as to what the workload is.
Right. What were some of the, like, when you mentioned, you know, growing up when you were a kid, what were some of the, like, the animation titles that you enjoyed, like, as a kid on those Saturday morning cartoons? What do you remember being enthralled by?
My number one favorite cartoon as a kid was Cops. It was stood for Citizens Organization of Police Specialists. It took place in the future. And I just, to me, it was like this, one of the first visions of the future that I was just like, totally taken with. And like, even now, you know, Afrofuturism and futurism, speculative fiction are like some of my favorite genres to play in. And so, right. Yeah, that is one that that's the one that I would get up at 6 a.m. on Saturday before all my brothers and everyone else, so I could co-op the TV and watch Cops. And I don't even know how many seasons it was on. I mean, I was a kid, my head was on for like 10 years, but it probably was like a 1 or 2 season show, but that was the one. And something that stood out about that one and for me, and I think, you know, kind of carries through now with all the DE&I work I do, the captain of that police squad was a Black guy named Bulletproof. And and I remember just being in awe of this character. It's one of the first Black characters I saw in such a position of power and leadership. And just, he looked really cool. He had like a cyborg body. Like, I just thought he was the dopest dude. So yeah, Cops was probably my favorite. Thundercats, of course, is up there. I think it was this weird kind of fantasy future, science fantasy kind of adventure that, you know, going back and looking at it now, doesn't totally hold up story-wise, but I just visually, I think there were some great ideas. And even within that world, maybe the stories weren't the strongest, but the concepts behind a lot of these creatures and the characters you had were just so imaginative and still are so imaginative to me. So it's these seeds of like, imagination that really took me with some of that stuff.
Yeah, I was also a big Thundercats fan myself, and like, you know, the mixture of technology and, you know, then you also had swords and, you know, magic. It was a nice combination. It was kind of, in a way, sort of maybe a competitor to, you know, like the, like He-Man, which I was also into. That also had the same kind of feel of swords and magic and also lasers and Thundercats was, it was just beautiful. I was actually just recently showing my kids like some of the like the Thundercats theme song. They're like, oh wow, that looks, yeah, we want to watch that. May have some young Thundercats fans, and they've seen 3 episodes so far of the original He-Man. So I'm trying to get them into some 1980s, you know, inspiration.
I mean, I tell people the best time to be a kid, and a lot of people will argue, I'm sure, but man. The 80s, you know, between the cereal and the cartoons, I was golden.
Yeah, that was a good mix, definitely. So I wanted to ask questions about, you know, some activism that you may be involved in, like that you're involved in. You are originally from Tulsa, Oklahoma, so you and I have that in common. In fact, right now I'm wearing a T-shirt from our high school. You saw this is a...
I sure did.
Let me just show it to you here. I got this is a... Okay. It says Booker T. Washington's right there.
That's right. Come on, Hornets.
Yeah. If I turn around to the back, I can show you it's got the Hornet logo on the back there.
All right.
I don't know if you can see that. Yeah. I'll let you know where you can get these T-shirts. We're not a sponsor. They're not our sponsor, but I'll send you a link. It's a great shirt. And
y'all wouldn't have us without them. So, yeah.
Yep, exactly. So I wanted to ask you about your activism in the community of Tulsa. You are the director of outreach and public relations for Black Queer Tulsa. Can you tell us about your role and how you participate?
Yeah, so Black River Tulsa is relatively new. I moved back to Tulsa during during lockdown and in 2021, and almost immediately, it's kind of, you know, I've been involved in various like forms of like civic programs and activism in LA. And going back to Tulsa, number one, I was really surprised at the activist community that was there. But some, I actually met our founder, who Daniel McHenry, and his story, you know, I'm not going to tell all of it. That's totally his. But he had been very active in his church. And when he came out, essentially what it felt that he was abandoned and was kind of, you know, a lot of the community turned their back on him. And he realized as a Black gay man, there weren't any resources. There was no place. There was no really community existing for him. So he actually had started founded the group in 2019, well before the pandemic. Of course, everything hit, and that, you know, that put a break in everything. So when I was arriving in Tulsa in 2021, he was like, "Yes, I'm trying to get this group off the ground." And my response was, "Group, I love starting groups." So what do we have to do? And so along with him and several other members, we kind of just, you know, hammered out a vision and started putting on events. And the response was, I don't know how to describe it. It was just, it's like people just came out of nowhere. And like, we had our first event actually during Tulsa Pride in 2021. And we do a little kind of Pride after party. And we were like, "Hey," we put it on Instagram. We weren't sure who was going to show up, and we packed the place. Mm-hmm. And so many people were coming to us who were like, "Oh my gosh, I moved here and I just assumed I was going to stay home and go to work. And there wasn't my community here. I didn't have a place." And so for me, you know, over the years, just we've kind of just grown and grown. On our Facebook group, we have probably, we're probably approaching 200 members or so. Don't quote me on that, but you know, this is in the course of a year. And like with all the groups and organizations I have been involved in my life, the speed and the livelihood that has come out of this, of Black Queer Tulsa, it's not like anything I've seen before. I think a lot of it is a function of Tulsa being a city of its size. But I also think there was just a real need for community. And not only were people coming to us and showing up and just participating, we have to this day, people come like, they're like, "What can I do? How can I help?" And we actually successfully threw Tulsa's first Black Pride celebration just this past June. And once again, just the way we had sponsorship, we had corporate support, we had so much community support and so many people show up and so many people coming from the most unexpected corners of the community showing up, and we, you know, families and so many things that was really inspiring and like remind me, it's like, okay, this is making a difference. This is something that has never happened before, and it's something that Tulsa really needed. And so that's kind of just kind of my version of the story of Black Queer Tulsa. But on top of that, what my role is with outreach. And to be honest, we didn't do a whole lot of outreach in this first year. It really was more about kind of building the community, and there's a lot of kind of internal like housekeeping that as we learn new things, how do we make sure the organization is still viable moving forward? So we've just become an official 501c3. And we've kind of been laying out, you know, our 1 year future plan. And that will involve a lot more outreach. It's going to be looking, you know, working with schools and working with school organizations. There's an organization, Youth Services of Tulsa, which does a lot of work with, you know, homeless youth. And we want to make sure we're reaching out there and just making sure we're reaching out and being in those spaces where we know we're most needed. And, you know, it's Oklahoma. So politically, there are a lot of challenges to us. There are a lot of people that don't want to see us there and don't want to see us succeed. And while that was a fear of mine early on starting out, I'm only excited now because I'm like, okay, we have enough influence. We have enough of a presence now that we can combat that. We can combat the folks who want to, you know, push us aside and push our community away. So that's all I'll say. You know, is I've kind of been, you know, on the leadership board, and just the growth and what we've been able to build is something that I never expected to see in Tulsa.
Yeah, that's good to hear. You know, I've been, you know, away from Tulsa myself for quite a while. I don't get to visit very often. I've been in Japan now. This is my 18th year. So I haven't been able to visit since before the pandemic, but I'm always glad to hear, you know, positive things happening in Tulsa, especially, with, you know, coming from alumni like yourself. It's really great to hear. And just seeing Tulsa become, you know, more of a welcoming and acknowledging the diversity that exists, I think is really great to see. So, yeah, thank you for making our old hometown a better place, you know, and providing a sense of home to people that and community to people that didn't have it.
I appreciate that. And, you know, it's something I do like to say, though, is that, you know, when you look at Booker T, and especially those of us who, you know, who I feel like there's like a 10 to 15 year like window where there's just been this extraordinary people that were coming out of Booker T and are doing extraordinary things, much like yourself. You know, a lot of us are coming out and just creating, you know, right now in this day and age, creating content that's really pivotal. And, you know, the work you're doing, I mean, this really does make a difference for people to hear the stories and understand what's going on behind the scenes. And, you know, there may be that kid in Tulsa who was like you or me who hears this and is like, you know what? I am going to go try and work on a Star Trek show. I am going to go write and create an amazing fantasy epic that's going to rival, you know, Thundercats and Star Trek. So, So I commend you as well, just for like, you know, we're doing amazing things out here in the world and making a difference.
Yeah. So I wanted to ask another kind of activism, like as someone as part of the production of content that's, you know, available everywhere. Are you also a member of, for example, a union like IATSE or some other production union yourself? Or
I am not. And so and a lot of people in animation right now, you'll see that some of the production teams are working to unionize. What we have in animation, there's the Animation Guild, which is the animation union, but it's primarily like folks who are on the creative side. So the board artists, directors, I believe the writers are all part of like the Animation Guild, and that's the union. There is work being done to build some production unions. I don't know if you've heard, but it is slipping my mind. There's a studio out of the East Coast that successfully unionized. And I think they have a West Coast branch that's working at it. And so that movement is kind of happening right now. But I'm not a member. And also, you know, being in the executive space, there's not really a union for this level of work.
Yeah, I understand. Yeah, I definitely understand that. Like, for example, in where I am in Japan, you know, like a middle management can join union, but like if it's somebody who's, you know, for example, signs a check or has firing power, then they wouldn't be able to just because of that dynamic there. And then I know that, you know, I'm also helping to unionize in the US and in the spaces where I'm helping to unionize. They also sometimes we have people from corporate that are not managers, but they are corporate, and as well as like retail and call centers and things like that. So yeah, I definitely understand it can be tricky just given your position, even if you do support such a thing. Yes. Maybe you're not even able to really to talk about it, but I remember. Go ahead.
Well, this is, you know, it is tricky, right? And this, but you know, I do like to, I will say, especially among, I think the animation industry is kind of unique in a certain way in that there is a lot of support from some, you know, these higher levels. I don't think there's that hostility that you find in a lot of spaces towards unionizing. Now, at the same time, you know, there's still probably some challenges, but it's not like there's this conversation of like those darn unions. Not the attitude amongst at least the people I work with, the folks I work with, would say are generally supportive. But, you know, there's definitely challenges, and like that's a, you know, I am kind of keeping an eye on it and seeing how it grows. And I do have friends who are working in that space and doing really great work, but it is work. And so, it's hazy. And also because, you know, there isn't really a precedent for it and not really a model for it. Right. It's, you know, you're kind of building a car from the wheels up, and, you know, it's exciting to see it happen, though, to be honest.
Yeah. I recall news, I believe it was early last year, where like the animators from Lower Decks announced that they had unionized. I think they're in Canada, I think. Yeah.
Yes.
Is that what you were thinking of?
Yes. And I cannot think of the studio name. And I have friends who are on Lower Decks who are probably going to destroy me. But
we'll add it in post.
Yeah, right. So But yeah, no, that success is such a great sign. And like, we now know it's possible. We now know it can be done in that. There's the rules of Canada and the rules of the US, and like, everyone, you know, that fight's going to have its own nuances. So.
Right. So I wanted to ask, like some prodigy specific questions. I know that, I won't ask you anything that'll be spoilerish, because I know that, yeah, you know, being part of the actual production from start to finish, I know you could get into spoiler territory easy. So, first I wanted to see if you noticed I got the, prodigy badge going on here.
Very much so.
Adding some post-production, I'm going to see, like, when I push this, you can see this nice hologram going up. So you can say, wow, look at that. Yeah.
All right, man.
I'm going to add that in post. So, yeah. I'm going to do the little third century kind of discovery thing where they got the holograms coming out. So, yeah, I'll add some of that in post-production.
Oh, man. Yeah. We'll have to have that conversation on another interview, right?
Yeah, exactly. What was your first interest in Star Trek, like, as a fan? What was the first, for example, series that you watched or that got you into it as a whole?
Next Generation. My dad was it's weird. My dad was like a very like straight kind of like man's man, kind of like straight edge kind of guy, but he loved sci-fi. Uh-huh. And, was a huge Star Trek fan growing up from the original series. So when Next Generation came out, I was 6 or 7 years old. And I remember my dad being like, 5 o'clock Saturday, the family is sitting on the couch and we're going to watch this show. And that was like 5 o'clock Saturdays for us. And so I grew up loving Star Trek. And it's another one that was like, visually, I'm like, oh my gosh, this vision of the future was so... Yeah. So wild. And so I was amazed by the ideas at the time. You know, just every episode was like, oh my God, I can't believe this thing is happening to these people in space. And so Next Generation was my initial, my introduction to the franchise. Deep Space Nine was me and my mom. My mom really was into that one, and I fell in love with it. And to this day, that's probably my favorite of the Star Trek series. Hmm. And then Voyager came out my freshman year at Booker T. And that one was mine. I was like, it was on UPN. It was a brand new ship. And, you know, I had the encyclopedia. So I was like, oh my gosh, we're gonna have to update our history and a new captain and Janeway, like just one of the baddest characters on TV of all time. And so Voyager is the one that I feel like I owned. And then, you know, just through college, I was just that Star Trek nerd. I had all the facts on the shelf. But it started with Next Generation. That was when I really fell in love with it. So have you watched the new series Strange New Worlds?
Yeah. I finished that one. And, that was amazing. Yeah. To me, I'm caught up on all the current series. Like, I feel like we're in a new golden age of Discovery, Strange New Worlds, Lower Decks. I've seen everything that's produced right now that's new. And Prodigy, of course.
Exactly. Yeah, no, I'm caught up as well. And just like, the reason I brought this Strange New World, to me, it feels like, you know, I like that, you know, it's a little lighter than Discovery, but it feels like, it has the feel of the original series for me.
Yeah.
And part, you know, I said to a friend recently, I was like, this feels like, I feel like this is the show that Gene Roddenberry wanted to make. You know.
It's one of the great things that people have mentioned about it is that it's very episodic. It doesn't have, it does have some themes that overall arc throughout the character development themes that go from start to finish, but it's not like you can miss an episode and see the next episode. You're not completely out of the water because it's not just one big arc. Like, for example, when Discovery came through, it had several huge arcs throughout plot lines throughout the, it was like the, everything in this episode was dependent on the previous episodes, and you don't have that kind of dependency in Strange New Worlds as much, and so it does make it a lot lighter in that way.
Yeah, there's a little less, you know, for lack of a better term, a little less labor in watching it, and that's not a negative. Like, I think to me, it's like the differences in the shows. To me, that's each what makes them all so special. You know, I love that Discovery feels like a novel. Each season feels like a novel for me, and you know, there are these heavier, darker themes that to me, I'm like, okay, like this is, this probably is what would happen if you had these circumstances. Mm-hmm. And so with Strange New Worlds, like I said, that episodic, you know, it's great. It's less layer to kind of follow. And I like that, you know, overall it's lighter. And then, you know, you do have those little goofy nods with like the funny music at times. You're like, you know, that little button in a scene that kind of made the original show so special. So it's almost like, you know, it's a mirror in certain ways to the original series. And I feel that way about a lot of the newer ones. Even Discovery, to me, Discovery has a lot of that tone of Deep Space Nine, especially those later seasons. So I just think it's such a wonderful franchise because we're playing in this universe, this literal like galaxy and universe, and we're getting so many different windows into the stories of it. So I really love that about Star Trek as a whole.
Yeah. So like Star Trek Prodigy is one of the first Star Trek series to target really a younger audience. And I think it was a smashing success for that. Like I got my two 10-year-old twin boys into it. Uh-huh. And they've watched different Star Wars series. And then so, you know, anything with too much dialogue is not that interesting for them. It's not going to hold their attention. But this was such a great mix. Like they were enthralled from the beginning to end of you know, the series. And as was I. But I wanted to ask about like production time. Like when you're doing the story for the series, I'm assuming you had to write all 10 episodes at once. And then how does the production go? Do you actually work on one episode at a time, or is everything in development all at once?
A plan is kind of laid out, and this kind of just general with a lot of animation. Usually there's kind of a plan made, but it's like episodes are produced like kind of on a cycle, if that makes sense. You have kind of like the timeline for episode one, and it overlaps with episode two and episode three. There's an overlap for sure. And so you may, you know, the crew may be working on, you know, three or four episodes at one time, but at different stages of the production. Mm-hmm. And then you roll through that for the entire season, if that makes sense. And so, you know, once you ship the materials for episode one, you're probably like, you know, you might be in the board stage for episode two, and then you might be just wrapping up the script in episode three. So, you know, there's kind of like a stacked kind of production cycle that happens with each episode. Right. Yeah. Does that answer your question? I feel like I'm...
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I was wondering like about how much, if it was even possible to calculate like how much time it took to produce one episode, because you're probably going into the next episodes before the first one is finished, right?
Right. I mean, if you want to go if you're looking at from a finished script, from like a finished script to, you know, ready for air animation, you're looking at probably about a year for each right. episode. And that's kind of a rule of thumb with most animation. So whether it's mm-hmm. 2D or CG or whatever, I found with television in the US at least, that's about the production time for the actual animation.
Right.
And of course that now I'm including, you know, and there I'm including the board stage, I'm including the animatics, I'm including, you know, the actual animation and post.
Right.
But yeah, that's a rule of thumb. So even SpongeBob still, you know, that's about the same thing for a SpongeBob episode. So it's because it goes by quick, though. I tell people that it's there's so many times when people are like, all right, hey, this will be the last script. I'm like, wait a minute, what? Like, didn't we just start, you know, didn't we just do the season premiere, or didn't we just do our Christmas special?
Yeah.
And before you know it, you're, you know, starting to talk about the next season and, you know, pickups and, you know, what is that next stage for you? But yeah, it's a very fast paced kind of process.
And a lot of the development I'm sure is probably initially is because you got to develop all these characters, all their backstories. And there's little Murph over here too. You got to get all those characters and their backstories going. And you got to develop their character arc through that as well. So I'm imagining that maybe the first season, because of that, and like we've mentioned before, is the most is going to be the most intensive compared to something that's been going for a little while.
Yeah, like first season, like I, you know, like say people, I was like, you know, the first season, that first episode, in a perfect world, I would give it, you know, every stage twice as long as normal expected. And, that would be, getting that script down, getting the designs down, getting the backgrounds, like every stage, I think I would like to say, give them twice as long because you're doing it the first time. You're going to learn things along the way that will change the story. You're going to, something will happen and some story will come up or even some technical background thing will come like, you know what? We can't do this character this way. We're going to have to we need to figure out this character, spend some more time developing this character, developing the story beat. Something is going to come up that's going to need more time and take a revision or an extra step or something like that. That's been my experience. The first seasons are usually a little bumpy. And I think that's probably true across the, live action animation. I think that's probably true in all things TV. And, you'll hear all the time about like, if you go back and look at this, you'll notice in season two of this show from 1994, they changed the X, Y, or Z. Why'd they do that? Because some crazy behind the scenes fact you hear about. So those things happen all the time. In animation, they definitely happen a lot. There'll be unaired pilots that, that I've been able to come across working in the industry and be like, had no idea because it's never been on air. So, the first of anything in animation are always a little more work.
Right. Now, there was a lot of nice reveals and callbacks during, you mentioned that you had to have a lot of details and you gotta make sure everything's in line. There was a lot of callbacks and one of the biggest character reveals, of course, which we knew was coming, was like the first time Janeway appeared on the screen, albeit hologram form here, of course, in the beginning as their trainer. How exciting that was that when you first learned that, you were going to be able to work basically with Janeway and in a way after, your love of Voyager.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, Voyager was mine. So when I was like, are y'all serious? Like it was one of those moments where I'm sitting in the room and everyone's talking and like they mentioned, and when I learned it, I am proud of myself for holding my composure in that moment. And I think I did at one point leave to my friend and I was like, you guys have any idea what this means? And that person was not as much a fan as me. And they're like, oh yeah, well, I guess she was like the first female captain. And I was like, and yes. And like, just the best, like she's my favorite captain,
right.
I mean, I go back and watch episodes of Voyager and like, that's one where I'll pick a random episode. Right. And just, I'm like, that's the ship I would have been on. I would have gotten lost in the Gamma Quadrant and gladly hung out with Janeway. So.
And and we, at the very, very end of the last episode, we get to see Admiral Janeway as the character, as opposed to the holographic teacher on board the Protostar. But even, I love how even on board the Protostar, they have her character with her characteristic coffee drinking here. Nice. I love that, how they added that in as part of the AI. And there is a close-up scene where you notice there's a scene here where they show from the back and you can see there's not actually any coffee in the mug. She's going through the motion, but she's not actually drinking coffee because of course she's a hologram. But I love that they're doing that, but they go to the point to say, this is how the AI is programmed as a tribute to the real Janeway. And I love that little bitty detail there where there's not actually any drink in the mug.
I mean, and that's something I really love about the show. I mean, again, it's like, I feel like I'm living like any Star Trek fan's dream because like I have been like into the inner sanctum and seeing how people are constructing the show and the way there are very specific goals when we're making these callbacks. The team is like, okay, we'll get a story idea. And they're like, okay, well, what does this relate to that we've done already? What, how could we, they're very conscious of the fans, right? Of our fandom and honoring the fandom and honoring the support. And so little things like that, the detail for the technology, all those things are like very deliberate. And
yeah.
you know, our showrunners are, you know, the Hageman brothers, Kevin and Dan Hageman. They just have such respect for not only for the franchise, but for storytelling and good storytelling and nailing what our demographic and our audience really needs and wants to see. And so, you know, pointing these things out, they know they were very well aware what it would mean the moment we saw Janeway on screen. Right. They were very well what it meant to have Admiral Janeway and to continue her story in this show. And, you know, why do this in the kids show and not in one of the main series? Why don't we have a Janeway series on Paramount Plus? This, to me, this makes perfect sense for who Janeway is, what her character is. Of course, she is a teacher and a leader in a certain way, this motherly figure to these young aliens. And so, to me, all that was very deliberate and very well thought out. And I love being able to be in the rooms and watch it all come together.
Yeah. And another callback that which made me laugh out loud is when Dahl is playing this game, which we know was an addictive game that was intent on mind control from TNG, where Wesley Crusher had on a vacation, had to come and save Data so that Data could help save the rest of the crew at the last minute. Yeah, this was this addictive game that he's playing right before the crew walks in. That was just hilarious to me.
And this is another one of the things that, you know, again, I don't know that everyone's the Star Trek fan that I am. But most folks aren't the Star Trek fan that I am on the show. And so when I see things like that, I remember seeing that in the animatic and be like, and I was like, did anyone else get that? Did anyone else see that? Did anyone catch that? And it's sometimes a lot of fun. And someone's like, no, what is that? I'm like, oh my God, and I'm pulling up the episodes and I'm showing, it becomes this like really great experience. And one of my coworkers on the show, she talks about her son. She's like, oh my, like me and her son basically have this like connection we made mostly over Zoom because, you know, we're talking about something. She's like, okay, let me go pull him in. I'm like, okay, what did you think? What did you think of the show? And he's asking about it. And I'm like, well, that's from this episode. And I'm giving him like homework to go watch these older episodes. And so.
Yeah, that's what that was my next question is like, how much homework were you assigning people that you were as part of your management duties?
A lot, you know. I mean, I'm not sure how often people do it, but, you know, I love being able to reference an episode, you know, like so far we've seen. Oh my gosh. I mean, this, you know, the Kobayashi episode, which you brought up, you know, it's like when I first saw the premise for that, I was over the moon, not only because I'm like, oh my gosh, you guys figured out how to honor so much of Star Trek in one 22-minute episode. You've pulled in all these folks and like, you know, we see Spock, we see Uhura, we see Odo, like these iconic figures, and you've made them all work together, and to see them all on the Enterprise bridge essentially, I mean, my little Star Trek heart blew up.
This is my Kobayashi screenshot here. You can see I'm kind of kind of cropped out. We got Uhura over here, we got Odo, we got Scotty, Spock, and Wesley Crusher there, and you've got Captain Dahl here with a very determined look to try to get through this, and amazingly it looks like he does get it without cheating, just by doing absolute chaos is what he says. And then he actually just manages to blow up the ship by resting his feet at the very, very end. He lets his guard down, but he still gets an extremely high score. So I was very impressed by that storytelling, because we all know that Kirk won by cheating, by changing the test, and Dahl managed to actually get through it. It looked like with a win, 99% of a win.
Yeah. No, and I think what's really cool about this is that, you know, back to like kind of the legacy of Star Trek, you know, Dahl is our leader. He's not necessarily a captain, but like, you know, what kind of marks every series is that the captain is always a little bit of a misfit, a little bit, you know, outside the box thinker. And Dahl is like the ultimate version of that. Yeah. And so, you know, I even just love this image because I'm like in this mind, I'm almost like, here's this wild captain with, you know, our Spock and our Dr. Crusher, these very grounded crew members and, you know, folks who are like kind of very down to earth, and Dahl essentially leading them. And I mean, to me, it's just, this image just is so powerful and says so much. And on top of that, what I love about the episode is like, I remember coming away and be like, oh my God, Dahl's a gamer, you know, and like, you know, he's like, not only a gamer, but he's got to play the ultimate game and like the game that we all want to play. Like, wouldn't it be cool if we all got to go into a holodeck and like do the Kobayashi. And yeah. So, you know, this is almost like such an aspirational episode for so many folks in our audience who we know are gamers. And to me, it's just kind of honors like that sect of our, you know, fandom that in a way that you know, we can identify, because DAO is one of us.
Yeah, exactly. One of the episodes, could you pinpoint an episode that was like your favorite? I mean, we've talked about this one and we've talked about others. Like, did you have an episode that, I mean, you're not supposed to play favorites with your children, right? But was there any episode that really spoke to you on a personal level?
I think the season finale was the two-parter, and I'm Nicola's gonna
get a moral star enough. Part one and two.
Yes, moral star. To me, that one, not only from behind the scenes, but story-wise, just brings everything together so well.
Yeah.
And, you know, really, it honors, like, who these characters are, who have come from essentially being, you know, enslaved, and all the growth, you know, them growing as a unit, and the camaraderie and the love they have for each other, and becoming this family unit, and now having to, like, face their greatest fear, this person, this diviner who they have escaped. They now have to go back.
Here, I really like this image with them coming down to face the diviner as a team. And this is where they get a shocking message where the diviner is demanding that Gwyn, his prodigy, come with him. He's changing the terms of the deal. I thought it was a lot of fun, because at this point, I did not realize that Zero was not Zero, but spoiler alert, that's actually Murph hiding in there holding the Protostar engine. I love that little plot point there.
Another thing that's like there's so many times I'm like, oh my god, that's so Star Trek. That was a that's so Star Trek moment to me. Yes. And you know, seeing them in these, like, you know, it was, you know, now here they are together fighting for each other versus episode one, where Gwyn is interrogating Dahl, right? Zero is this figure that Dahl's like, oh, you know, Dahl is possibly going to betray, you know, Rock-Tok and Dahl, like, you know, Rock-Tok, they were chained together and about to fight. You know, there's all these things, and now they've become this unit where they are ready to sacrifice so much for one another.
Right.
And so it's like this episode just speaks so much to everything we built over this entire season.
Right.
And I also think back, you know, I think it's kind of a interesting kind of reflection of episode 105, where they first on Murder Planet, which to me is one of the most beautiful episodes.
Yeah.
But also that episode starts with them getting off the ship and they all run off and do their own thing and don't really think about each other. And then they have to come together. And so to me, it's like, these are kind of these different stages of their growth as a family and as a crew. And, you know, that's how I'm going to think of them. And that's what this episode does so well. It brings it all together. And also behind the scenes, you know, from all the challenges early in the season, this is the episode where it came together. And like the music, the emotion of it all is just so beautifully synthesized. So that was probably like my favorite episode of what we've seen in season one.
Yeah. I like that as well. I like, for all the reasons that you said, like you really finally see them coming together as a unit, and their plan came together like the A-Team in another 80s reference there.
Yes, yes.
And then, that was really beautiful. I also really liked, the Time Amok episode where they're stuck in a time loop. As I really love the way that science fiction will create spaces, especially with time travel, where a character is in isolation and they have to figure out how to do things on their own in order to get back to their family. And I really love stories of loneliness. Like I really liked Discovery at the beginning of season three, Discovery, when, you know, Sinequa Martin Green, Captain Burnham, now Captain Burnham, where Michael Burnham is on her own for a year, and has to figure out how to get by on her own and face the fact that she may never see anyone again. And that's what it sort of reminded me of when Rock is on her own for what looks like maybe a year or two, you know, from the marks she's got on the wall. And she has to learn just all, she put herself through college, basically, through Starfleet Academy in order to help save her crew and bring her family back together. And like this moment was really like, kind of brought a tear to my eye, really.
You know, I love about this, because, you know, that's a lot of things, you know, it's Nickelodeon, we're kids first. And so it's like, how do you tell a heartbreaking story for 6 to 11-year-olds? And we pulled it off, you know, like that's how I felt. I mean, and I love that this is the shot you pulled, because like, I remember seeing, even in animatics, seeing that moment and seeing the house, like, oh my gosh, I think this is their first group hug that that's been prominently featured. Right. And that says, again, says so much about how we've grown from that first episode, Lost and Found. And so, yeah, that's another episode. Also, just conceptually, you know, we struggled a lot in the beginning. I was like, are people going to get this? Is our kid audience going to understand how this happens? And now when I look at it, I was like, wow, like visually it was done so well. Story-wise, it just was structured in a way that this is now a clear story with a somewhat, you know, complicated concept at its core of time travel.
Yeah, like, you know, in Japan, you know, my kids, they're 10 years old now, and we've watched enough movies where they're accustomed with what in Japanese, they just call it time slip. That's what they call time travel episodes. So I remember when we watched, we were doing the Harry Potter movies, and there's the one where they do a lot of time slip is what they call it. So they were kind of able to understand the concept now at 10 years old. And you know, I explained, this is like time slip, but each person has different speed. And so they're like, oh, and like I remember during the episode, there's the animation where you're going from fast to slow, and they have that animation where you're going to different points. And I thought that was visually a great way of storytelling that, and letting the kid visualize it so that they can see that the characters are at the same time, but at different place.
Yes.
Or and different place, same place, different time.
Right. And we spent a lot of time, you know, figuring out how to make that work. What was the best way to get that across? And again, you know, another place where what a great crew, everyone from the writers to our CG team, to our designers, everyone was like on board to figure out, how do we do this? How do I do this? How do I take my craft and make sure this story works in the best, clearest way? So I'm glad. I love hearing that story, because I'm like, that's what I like to hear. I want to know that our 10-year-old twins are understanding the time slip. So
yeah, exactly. Yeah. I know that you said you really, really love Janeway as a character. Are there any of the new characters? I know we're not supposed to have favorites for our children again, but are there any characters that you identify with personally, like in Prodigy?
You know, Gwen, I somewhat identify with, and it's kind of an obscure reason. You know, for me, it was like, also as a kid, me and my family moved around a lot. Right. And so, you know, my family was the most important thing to me. And, you know, for a lot of time, I was kind of neglecting my own needs, I was always looking outward and all, you know, and so it took a while for me to stop and to kind of step into my own and, you know, step away from the family and then, you know, see them as people and see them as these very complex complex people and see myself and understand myself away from that. And that's, I kind of feel like, I mean, my dad's not like an evil dictator, right? But, you know, in 105 Murder Planet, where you see her when he turns away from her, and she's like, she almost has this like kind of this identity crisis of like, who am I without service to this person I now know is not only pretty evil, but doesn't really care for me the way I thought he did.
Right.
And so being on that loan and having that moment of having to figure yourself out, I kind of compare it to me stepping out when I went to college when I first went to college. I mean, I was pretty sheltered, frankly, even through Booker T. Uh-huh. And I was suddenly out in this world. And I had this very, this period of really kind of very intentionally having to figure out my identity and be like, wait, Neil, who are you? And asking myself that question, what is it that makes you special and different and unique? And so I see Gwen having a parallel, yet far more tragic, path in that way. And so I've always kind of, she's always kind of resonated with me. You know, she is a bit more mature. She was sheltered. She was held back from all these things. And now she's out with this new crew and having to learn how to love and learning what love is and learning what real, true, like sacrifice for one another looks like. So that's Gwen is probably my parallel in the show.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm looking forward to see how, you know, the troubles that she faced at the end of the season are resolved, you know, and, you know, if she can even remember what her, you know, her father told her about what's going to happen and what's going to happen when they get the now infected ship back to the Federation. So, yeah, obviously, I know that, you know, we're not going to ask you for any spoilers because we don't want them. but I'm definitely looking forward to that. One question my kids had is Murph truly indestructible? Because it certainly looks like it. It looks like he can eat anything. And are we going to get some Murph backstory?
What I will say is that we will learn a lot more about Murph. And I think your kids will be happy to learn this new information. So
I'm definitely looking forward to that. Cause they really did. They love him. We're looking for a plush Murph doll at some point to be, gotta get one of those, something huggable.
Me too. And also, just so you know, that has been a discussion.
That's great. Yeah. Well, I think you've answered all of my questions. Thank you so much for your time. And I'm really looking forward to the next season and looking forward to everything afterwards. We're going to plug Black Queer Tulsa. We're going to plug, is there anything else you wanted to mention that, you know, that you wanted people to take a look at? We're going to suggest, what is it again? Banana Cricket. What was the name of it?
Big Goat Banana Cricket. Yeah.
Big Goat Banana Cricket. Yeah. Big Goat and also another thing like Cleopatra in Space from DreamWorks. Absolutely. Another thing for people to look up after they finish Prodigy while they're waiting on the next season. Yeah. So, but yeah, definitely looking forward to the next season.
Yeah. And I will say, I'm going to go and throw out, y'all check out Big Nate. It's another show I'm working on. Just another great crew creating a great show. I mean, it's really... To the audience, if you guys haven't seen it, get on it. It's absolutely gorgeous. Mm. And it's just one of those shows that's zany and escalates every single episode. So check it out.
Okay. Thank you so much. And
thank you.
Yeah, it's been great talking to you.
Likewise. I'll see you.
Okay. Eric. Thank you for watching. I hope this was entertaining and informative. I want to thank the amazing Neil Wade for his time and kindness. Something we forgot to show during the interview was this screen capture at the end of every episode of Star Trek Prodigy, where you can see the name of Neil Wade here, current series management. Please check out his activism with blackqueertulsa.org and consider helping out in your community as well. I want to thank my brother Randall Lipford for the Star Trek-ish music at the intro and his sound engineering skills throughout the episode. Randall also informed me that I made two mistakes while speaking, because twice when I was pointing at and referring to Beverly Crusher, I accidentally said Wesley Crusher. Apologies to the Crusher family. I would like to thank my partners at Meat Lake Production for the post-production assistance. You can find more about our VFX capabilities and all of our work at meatlake.com, which includes our original collaborative work on our Quantum Twins series. Please subscribe to our YouTube channel and let us know